Welcome to Zero Knowledge, a podcast where we talk about the latest in zero knowledge research and the decentralized web. The show is hosted by me, Anna.
And me, Frederick.
This week, I speak with Jacob, Mark, and Marco from the Tezos community. We chat about the network, the validator community, governance, and how they're looking to incorporate zero-knowledge proofs and other privacy tech into their system. But before we start in, I want to say thank you to this week's sponsor, Trail of Bits. Software makers and vulnerability researchers have a strange and contentious relationship when it comes to finding and reporting bugs. It's a relationship that has historically had a volatile imbalance of power that can be flipped in an instant. Disclosing too much information about a discovered vulnerability could ruin the reward for a third-party researcher's hard work. At the same time, improper disclosure of a vulnerability could permanently damage the reputation of a software company, and this is where the communication breaks down between the two parties. Trail of Bits has partnered with Johns Hopkins University to use zero-knowledge proofs to eliminate this need for trust between vulnerability researchers and tech companies. This is part of a larger effort funded by DARPA called CIV, with the goal of this being to push zero-knowledge proof research forward. For their part, Trail of Bits will work to supply researchers with software that can produce ZK proofs of exploitability. If you're interested in their work or you want to find out more about this project, keep an eye on the Trail of Bits blog. A blog post is set to land this week or next, and we'll be adding the link in our show notes. So thank you again to Trail of Bits for supporting the show. And if you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe to Zero Knowledge Podcast and do give us a review or a like wherever you're catching this. So now here's our episode on Tezos. So today we're going to be talking about Tezos. And I have three members of the community here to help me understand a little bit about Tezos, the governance, the validator community, and also how they've incorporated privacy into the system. So I'd like to welcome to the show Jacob Arluck, who's the co-founder of TQ, as well as Mark Bernardo and Marco Stronati, both from Nomadic. So welcome to the show, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
I think because you're from two organizations and because there's three of you, I think it's really important for us to understand kind of who you are. Let's start with you, Jacob. You are the co-founder of something called TQ. What is TQ and what is your relationship to Tezos?
So I've been involved in the project for about 2 years. So originally was involved with the foundation somewhat, you know, around the launch and helped with some of the operational needs around launch back in 2018. And then basically decided that we, you know, there was sort of no entity focused on, you know, adoption in the ecosystem broadly at the time. And so we decided to spin up a company in the US, in New York, basically that would be focusing on Tezos adoption.
Cool. And so like the Tezos organization though, isn't it mostly in France? Is that sort of the main spot of development?
Well, I guess it's sort of all over the world, but basically a lot of independent like teams, you know, between like, you know, the folks in, there's certainly like a huge, massive share of the project is in France for sure. Okay. There's also folks in US, some folks in Asia, and other parts of Europe. So Germany, a lot in Eastern Europe. You know, there's some in Ukraine, Russia, et cetera. But yeah, there's a lot of activity throughout Europe. Some activity in South America.
Okay, cool. All right. So Mark and Marco, you're both from Nomadic Labs. Tell me what Nomadic Labs are and what you do there.
Yeah. So maybe actually it's the first time that I heard somebody refer to Nomadic Labs as plural.
Oh, sorry. Is it Nomadic Lab?
No. I'm not sure actually. I need to check. Anyway, for now, there is one lab. Let's say that we're ambitious, so we call it labs. Maybe one day it's going to be more than one. So basically, from the start of the project, the core of the developers that developed the first prototype and then that work on it until the launch, they were in Paris for some historical reasons, I guess. And because basically the language that was chosen for the project and for the prototype, it's OCaml and it's kind of a Frenchy thing. A little bit. I mean, it's all over the world, but I would say it's kind of a Frenchy thing. So there is a bigger concentration of developers here in Paris.
And you're based in Paris as well, I guess.
Yeah, I'm based in Paris.
Cool.
So the companies, there are several people working abroad. But yeah, most of us are here.
Nice. And what's your role in Nomadic Lab?
So I've been there almost from the beginning. It was January 2018. And I would say I'm a senior developer, so I worked on a lot of different things. The stuff that I liked the most was working on the amendments. So maybe we'll touch on that later, but Tezos has this ability to evolve its own economic protocol. That's what we call an amendment. And so you need to write these things and make sure that they're correct. It's kind of a complex procedure. So we have three of them, and I worked on all of them.
So what about you, Mark? What's your role at Nomadic?
So I'm a cryptographer. Was hired a year and a half ago to work on the Sapling integration, which we're going to talk about. So we are finishing on that, and then I would work on privacy in a more general
Did all of you work kind of in blockchain or decentralized tech before joining these projects, or were you working in other spaces before that?
I was definitely not in this. So I've been, I don't know what I'm going to say, an enthusiast or follower of the space, especially in actually the project that sort of reignited my interest in, like, you know, so it was basically in 2016 was Zcash, actually, like, seeing it actually launch. Was like, I was like, wait a minute, stuff's going on again in this space. You know, there's actually cool stuff happening again. But no, I wasn't in the shoe before.
Yeah, me neither. I was very far from, actually not that far, but so I was working in research and mostly on privacy and ANSI technologies. So differential privacy and stuff like that for geolocation systems. So actually I was crossing paths with a lot of people working on blockchain, especially in my last year of postdoc. But I didn't see the spark there, but yeah, it came right after.
Cool.
And so me neither. I used to do a PhD in crypto at a payment company, which wasn't really decentralized at all.
In a payment company, like sort of a more traditional place?
Yeah, in Ingenico. Yes.
Okay. So what was it about this project, Tezos? Like what was the spark that got you to join this particular group, this particular network, or I guess community is a better way to say it.
Yeah, I feel like at least for myself is like really intellectual interest around the governance mechanism originally, and like just generally thinking that there are a lot of ideas in the project that I thought like were actually things that do help remove some of the barriers to like adoption of these technologies. Mm-hmm. So basically, I've always thought of Tezos as trying to keep the good things about blockchain, like and the actual promise of it, which is of like having the censorship resistant settlement layer, whatever you want to call, while also being able to evolve, while also being able to represent stakeholders, have safe, secure smart contracts, stuff like that. And obviously the whole proof of stake thing, which is all sort of tied into that. But it's not that it's like a better Ethereum or a better this or better that. It's more like it's sort of seeing it as like really trying to get at the root of like why these things are hard to adopt in sort of the broader world, which is in general, like that they get stuck at a certain point in time and don't evolve past there, or that they, that the smart contracts are not something that, you know, large institutions or, you know, sort of people handling large amounts of value feel comfortable, you know, using.
Hmm.
Yeah. For me, it was, I don't know, it was a sort of a miracle. I was doing a post for somebody that knows research. You know that postdocs are kind of a dark time in your life. And so it was indeed. And you always get this feeling that, so you work very hard, you do something, you try to solve problems that are so hard and you think they're very useful. At the same time, you get this feeling that nobody really cares. And especially, I mean, in US is not too bad, but here in Europe, you're not paid a great salary. You don't have a lot of security. Like you don't know what's going to happen in 6 months. So it's very, pretty tough. So I was in this spot, and then I was looking for a job at that point. I was like, okay, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to pay the bills. And then I see this email on the OCaml mailing list saying, yeah, we're looking for developers for this project. I don't know what that is. So I went to a meeting, and so somebody basically told me, it was in a cafe, actually, because there was no office or anything. So basically, this person told me, well, you can work on whatever you like. You can choose between this menu of super interesting topics. You can do whatever you want. You're going to work with brilliant colleagues, and you're going to be paid a normal salary, and everything's going to be awesome. I was really freaked out. Like, I was like, this is too good to be true. I'm sure there's a catch. Like, they will, I don't know, they will ask for my firstborn at some point or something like that. Hasn't happened yet. Everything's been great. So it was a big turning point. And it was, everything was true. Like, every interesting problem in computer science is in blockchain right now. And very smart people, very smart colleagues, and great, great environment.
Both you, Marco, and Jacob, you both joined quite early. As I understand, Mark, you joined a bit later.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. So I want to talk to you, Jacob, and Mark, and Marco, about that beginning. So were you there? Like, okay, the history of Tezos that I know is that it had a massive ICO during the summer of crypto, whatever we call that. And it was one of the first that had really kind of extraordinary numbers. I remember that. And like, it's one of the first POS systems to launch as well, to actually be live. So at what point in that sort of those two poles did you join this project? Were you there right from the start, or were you there after the ICO, or like at what point?
So there's this whole thing that happens in between there that maybe a couple months after that, May or June of 2018 or so. And so maybe the foundation was fixed in, like, when I say fixed, like, you know, basically they removed the sort of interesting leadership there in sort of probably late February. So it was like 2 or 3 months after that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, at the time there was like it was just like a hodgepodge of people kind of doing stuff. There was very little in the way of like any kind of, you know, clear organization or anything. It was sort of just people going at it in different directions. And one thing that's really crazy and a lot of people don't know about in the project broadly is that, so basically everyone had always talked about like Tezos, the government that does all this governance stuff, you know, and we're not. And we actually were like, well, wait a second. Like, no one's actually looked at like what this actually means. Like, and so I would go back between New York and Paris, like a good amount. And Marco and I are basically, you know, reviewed. In fact, I think with Arthur as well, you know, the way that the actual amendment process worked. So, and then we, you know, released a blog post about it. Like, people had always talked about, oh yeah, Tezos has this amazing governance mechanism. You can submit an invoice and get all this stuff. There was like very little back then in the way of like, wait a second, like, how does it actually, like, did anyone look in the protocol to see, like, you know, does it actually work the way people described?
Yeah.
And then the other thing was like, so wait a second, if we do this, like, practically speaking, what has to happen operationally, or like, you know, in general, you have these 450 validators over the world. Like, how are they going to engage with this this amendment process? So there was sort of, yeah. So there's a lot of that early on, things like that, where there were sort of like things that were promised, yeah, or just like stuff that was promised in a white paper, but like,
yeah,
like you have to figure out like how you actually do it, you know.
So let's. Marco, I want to hear about when you joined, but I also do want to explain maybe to our listeners who might not know that much about the project, that early hiccups that the project maybe hit, the early kind of conflicts within the foundation. So the ICO happened. There was a foundation created, a Swiss foundation that I guess held that ICO. And somewhere between that happening and you joining, there was something that happened. What happened?
Well, I really recommend reading the Wired article from like mid 2018. There was like a cover story of Wired. Like basically, I don't know that we have to relitigate it again. Again, it's been covered like many, many different times. But a lot of it stems from, you know, just stems from, like basically just the leadership having like some very in of the foundation at that, you know, at that time having very like self-serving priorities.
Yeah.
Put it that way. So a lot of that stuff is real. But like, I can't really, I mean, I wasn't really there for that. So like, I don't really like, I like, there's a pretty clear understanding of like the general tenor of what happened, but I would recommend reading the Wired article and other stuff about it and to make an opinion. It's like pretty clear that, you know, there was like somebody who did something that they, you know, and behaved in ways that they probably shouldn't have. Like, you know, it's really tragic because there was really no, like, you know, every, you know, sort of was not even in the end self-serving. It was like just self-destructive, you know, on that person's part. But yeah, and there's like, you know, all the different supporting actors.
Okay. Marco, what point did you join and what do you make of all of that?
I don't know, the way I lived it. I joined and we were in the high of the storm at that point. So I joined hoping that we will have offices and people coming in and a nice building, a nice startup. And in the end, it was a big mess. So we didn't, I think we didn't get paid for like a month or two.
Oh, man.
But I mean, we were, as developers, actually, we were really lucky and we were really shielded by all the mess, by some amazing people, administrators that that managed all the mess and managed to make us work like really without a problem. So we were a bit worried, but at the same time, we kept doing our thing and we were sure that things would go well eventually. And they did. So
cool. So coming out of that, like, so there had been this sort of, you know, big high of this ICO, then some big publicity in sort of a more negative way. But like, and actually, at what point did Tezos launch? What date was that?
So it was, so because of all this mess with the foundation and the delays, I think we could have launched after 6 months, more or less, just finishing touches. And because of this mess, we delayed everything until July 2018.
What, like Nomadic, where does that, was that the original company building it or is that a different organization?
So basically there was a kernel, I would say, of four developers that wrote like 99% of the original mainnet. They actually wrote too much, I think. They should have stopped earlier.
Why?
They over-engineered some parts.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, they're very good and they were very excited, I guess. So they wrote a bunch of stuff. It was all good. It was just very hard for us coming after trying to make everything
fit
in your brain. Yeah,
got it.
Steep learning curve. So yeah, so these four developers, they were working for another company that it was and it's still called Ocaml Pro, a very good company for Ocaml development. They do a bunch of very good products. And then because they needed to hire new people and they wanted to build something large, they decided to just spin off a new startup and they started hiring people.
Cool.
Ocaml developers.
Who are they? Who are they that you're talking about? Who are the theys?
So Arthur, that is the founder of the project, was very involved in that. And then there's Benjamin Canu, that is was one of the original architects, and he's still the CTO of Nomadic.
Cool.
Then there was Pierre Chambard, which is still working at Ocaml Pro, but he still collaborates with us for some topics where he's very good at. Then there was Grégoire Henry. It's really tough to alternate French and English accent. Anyway, so Grégoire was with us for another year and a half, I think, and then he decided to do something else. And I'm sure I'm missing somebody. Anyway, I don't know. I'll get slapped at the office next time.
Cool. And so what is then Tezos? What is it? How would you describe this network that you built in a nutshell?
So I think the first thing to understand is like think of it as sort of several things at the same time. So the first one is sort of, I don't want to call it like an organism, but basically this sort of self-aware or like self-governing economic infrastructure, or like, you know, I mean, at the base levels, I guess like form of computing system, although the world computer mantra of like early Ethereum is obviously has a lot of like sort of dark marks nowadays. But like, I think in general though, like there's definitely, I think from the beginning always been sort of positioned as a cryptocurrency as well, like more so a cryptocurrency than smart contract platform or world computer type thing. And so like, even if you look at Mikkelsen, like originally it was designed to be like a better formally verifiable version of Bitcoin script. I mean, it's Turing complete, et cetera, but like, and the move, the transition of the project has been over the past couple of years has been towards at least enabling, you know, like higher level like languages and things like that, that make it easy for people to build more expressive smart contracts and stuff like that. Like, you have to understand the white paper comes from 2014 and I think was even started in 2013. So like it basically means that, like, you know, this was really reacting to Bitcoin. I believe that Arthur, when he wrote it, he was working on it, and then like the Ethereum white paper came out and he basically like adapted his white paper based on, like, it wasn't, you know, like this wave of 2016, 2017 projects where, like, you know, it's like just like a bunch of like Stanford PhDs who realized that they could, you know, basically like convince anyone with a checkbook to fund them just because they had a better consensus algorithm. Like Tezos actually has the approach of like trying to be better at blockchaining. Wow. Like it's trying to be better at blockchaining, better not just in terms of technology, but like in terms of having a stronger like social consensus while also having better, you know, trying to have better technology. Like it's like that trying to have that combination, I think. That's the way I would explain it.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that the inception of it was so early.
Yeah, I think what sets it apart from other projects for me is the stressing the decentralization aspect. And this is something that Arthur has been really thorough about, and I think he's very right. This idea that you shouldn't. So that's why at the beginning of the when you said, are most of the people working in France? And I was like, oh no, not that. Like we really try to be open and to have as many people as possible join the project and build on the project. So I don't want to be labeled as the French blockchain.
French Ethereum is the other. the two labels on Tezos are OCaml Bitcoin and French Ethereum. So
oh, man, that's good.
So what? So even for OCaml, so we were very happy to learn that there are people building a new shell in Rust. So they're definitely welcome. So no problem. So basically whenever I start a presentation, I say, I'm going to tell you the way I've lived and seen things is just an angle. There are many. And so for sure, I'm going to be biased. This is not Tezos. This is the way I see Tezos.
For the first, like, I don't know if it was the first year of the project, but from launch, but I think there was like a huge sort of dark mark on using the word roadmap. Like the whole point of the white paper is that you don't have that there's no canonical roadmap. And so everyone was like, sort of like, there can be no roadmap, no roadmaps allowed. I think there's definitely been a transition back towards wanting like some amount of clarity from different developers on like what, you know, what's coming, when I'm sure we can cover that in this chat as well. But that's an interesting component too, is like there's a lot of purism around the language and a lot of purism around wanting to make sure that people understand that like Tezos isn't a company. Like, because there's really only two chains arguably that have meaningful perception as like independent organisms and or independent distributed systems or whatever, like, and those are really Bitcoin and Ethereum, right? And if you want to get into that bracket, you know, basically the only way you can do it is by not being a company, like, mm-hmm. you know, otherwise you're Tron or you're like, you know, one of these things that will blow up like a firework for 5 years, maybe, but then like, you know, they're never going to be, you know, a settlement layer for the world or something like that.
But I guess you're sort of highlighting a bit of a challenge of this. So you want a decentralized system. You don't want to, you're like, there's sort of fear of roadmaps or some sort of like single vision and you have this. It sounds like, I mean, there's an upgradability aspect where, like, there's governance that I guess is voting on decisions on how, you know, everything's going to evolve without maybe this supreme leader type. So how do you do that? Because that's a big challenge. Like, how do you, like, so has the attitude evolved from where it was, this purist attitude of, like, it must not have a roadmap to having a roadmap because you've accepted that there has to be a vision? Who can have the vision?
So I think everything was good the moment the most of the community understood what's an amendment. So the moment that you formalize the governance and you say, okay, these are the rules by which we're going to evolve, mm-hmm. then everybody can start their own roadmap. So after that, we could say, no, this is Nomadic Labs roadmap. And you know that is not Tezos roadmap because it depends on the amendments. So TQ can have their own roadmap and other Cryptium labs can have their own. And we will, they will need to meet at some point because the governance demands so. But after people understood that there, nobody could decide where Tezos goes, everybody could say, I think Tezos is going this way. I'm working for Tezos to go in this way.
Interesting. Actually, you just mentioned Cryptium Labs. Can you share a little bit about like who are the major players in this ecosystem?
So I can talk about development. So because these are the people I work with. So we mostly work with Cryptium Labs and with some people from TQ. And then there are a few other developers scattered around in Japan and Canada and elsewhere. But these are the sort of the biggest entities I work with, at least. And cool. I'm sure there are tons of others.
Also the language teams, right? So like SmartPy and Ligo and some of these other folks contribute as well. Like quite a lot to not, like they're not just building language. Like what happens a lot of times in Tezos is you have people go to build something, they find some area in core that they think should be improved from, that would make their project easier or better or whatever. And that's just like very common with the language folks. So the folks at Ligo and SmartPy are, you know, obviously, you know, they're seeing lots of different ways to improve things and contributing, I think, as well.
You're calling them language folks. Are they working on, you called it Mikkelsen?
Yeah, no, that's correct. Mikkelsen is the language that in the end is going to be interpreted on the blockchain. So, and then you can write your programs in whatever else you want, as long as it complies to Mikkelsen. That's it.
Nice. Are the founders like, this, are the founders still involved with this project? Like how, because I know that there's been some talk about this and I wondered if you could just like share.
I'm happy to take that one. So I think there's a very big misunderstanding of okay. If you go look at, for example, you go on GitLab and you go look at the Tezos core repository and you go look at a bunch of the issues, you will find Arthur replying to many of these different folks. You'll find, you know, him talk, you know, like he's very much still involved. He's very much still, you know, working on different. He's, you know, like I can't speak for him, you know, or Kathleen directly, but like I think what they were really arguing or saying was just that, like, you know, there are certain things that were lacking from Tezos that they want to see or want somebody to build, see someone build. And obviously don't have decision-making authority over any of that. So basically they were just like expressing some of those thoughts, I think. And I think they're very valid concerns around, like, you know, that we need to build better wallets, that we need, you know, that we'd hope to see things like, you know, stable coins or whatnot. And I mean, to answer the question though, I think without answering for them, I think it seems to me like they're, like, if at least factually, if you go on GitLab and you look at the, you know, many of the issues and stuff, you'll see Arthur there. Cool.
Do you think what people are perceiving is this decentralization where like different groups and different people have kind of like the community is governing it in a lot of ways? And so you don't have maybe those founders going on stages in the same way or something like that.
Yeah. Look, I mean, and also not just that, like governance is like at any meaningful scale, if you have have some form of like governance, it's going to be messy, right? And the other thing, and Tezos makes a lot of things cleaner and a lot of things better. It doesn't like solve the, you know, thousands year old challenge of governing, you know, right? I mean, it's just like, but point being, the other thing is like, you know, decentralization is messy. And like a lot of people want different things, or a lot of people want, you know, want to raise and lower the status of different like priorities or people or whatever. And so that, and that's like obviously an age old, you know, sort of behavior as well. So, so there's a lot of that as well, I think. And I think a lot of the things that people see from the outside are sort of indicative of just that kind of like messy ecosystem. And I think it's one of the things that I think about Ethereum, a lot of people criticize about Ethereum, but I actually think it's like one of the most positive signals about Ethereum, because it shows that it's something worth being controversial about, like what's something worth arguing about. Right. And same thing with Tezos, I think is like, it's to a lot of people, something worth arguing about and something worth, you know, sort of having different, you know, differences of opinion about.
Yeah. Sounds also, I mean, I think you can see, if you look across the ecosystem, you can see different networks have kind of at different stages along this path and having some growing pains as well. Like if you look maybe at what, you know, Cosmos has experienced over the last few months, and what, in a way, what you see is a path towards more decentralized power. And it's a bit messy sometimes, I think. But that's interesting. So let's move on to this validator community, the Tezos validator community. Was Tezos the first POS system? Am I wrong in thinking that it was? Or was it the first big one?
I think so. I think there was another one.
Oh, there was like Steemit, I guess, before that, eh?
Well, like NXT or whatever, that one. Oh, yeah. I think there's something called NXT. And then there's also something called like Peercoin or something like that. But the thing I'd say about POS is there's a huge misunderstanding about like, so there's, I feel like there's DPoS, which is like.
Yeah. Delegated proof of stake.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting one. The best way I've ever heard it is that it's kind of like inside baseball masquerading as civil resistance. So like that's a, that one is, I think, not the goal here, right? The thing that's unique about Tezos, I think, is that it has between 400 to 450 validators. It's like, it's definitely the largest validator community in turn, I assume. And if you actually go look on a map of like where all the validators are, like, you know, there's really good geographic distribution. But yeah, in general, you know, the validator community in Tezos has like been through a lot and seen a lot. And from early on, I feel like the thing that difference, you know, has always differentiated Tezos from other proof of stake networks is just simply this big focus on self-baking and people hobbyists baking and stuff like that, rather than on pure professionalization and data center based, you know, validation. And so that's definitely like one of the backbones of the network. And it's, and it segues really tightly into the governance question, because the governance process is very high. It requires a very high consensus in order to move anything forward. And that gives a lot of say to this very diverse validator community, which ranges from exchanges to professionalized validators, to hedge funds, to, you know, people with just like a spare Linux machine that they're running a validator on. So there's like sort of this really, the amendment process is very much like mediating the values and interests of all those different folks.
And you just used the term baking, which is unique to Tezos. And baking
French project.
what does baking mean? What is a baker?
Baking equals staking, right? So
got it.
So I mean, the joke is that that's the one, you know, French origin project. So let's call it baking instead of staking.
Okay, and the bakers are the validators, basically, or block producers.
Yeah.
So I think the there is a bit more maybe meaning to the words. So mining, I don't know, in my head, mining, when you mine, you work a lot, and if you're lucky, you will find a gold nugget or something. While baking, it's a craft, so you just need to know how to do it, and then it's effortless. Like you can bake whenever you want, especially if you're confined at home.
And you put in some ingredients and you get out some other ingredients, I guess.
Yeah. So this was try to put a big difference in between the mining and baking, so that anybody, even with a Raspberry Pi at home, can bake blocks.
Is what kind of POS system, like what is the underlying consensus in Tezos? Is it Tendermint or is it something else?
It's something else. Mm-hmm. I think it's maybe Ouroboros is a more popular
Ouroboros
algorithm that is similar to ours. But they were developed at the same time. They share a lot of ideas, but also several differences.
Cool.
It's a unique algorithm as far as I know.
I was going to say the original Tezos proof of stake is different. So that's the beauty of this whole amendment process thing. Like actually the nature of the consensus algorithm has changed as well. Not like massively, but like it's, you know, it's
significant.
Like yeah. Like it's not a totally new model, but all I'll say is that the original version of Tezos proof of stake was actually very, very similar to like normal Nakamoto consensus. So like basically it's like, imagine you took Bitcoin and instead of, you know, sort of your proof of work as the longest chain, you said, we'll just like, you know, basically have people endorse, you know, the endorse blocks, and then we'll slash people who try to double bake and try to endorse or bake multiple blocks, right? And so basically it's very similar. So longest chain based, you know, consensus algorithm.
Like you sort of say there's a new consensus algorithm used. Was that like the one that it was launched with, or was it actually changed mid?
No, it was changed mid. Like there was a block. There is a block. There's an amendment called Babylon. And, you know, the block before Babylon was activated, the network was baking with, you know, ME, which is called ME. And then the block that Babylon started, the network switched over to ME Plus, which is what the new one is. And ME, by the way, is named after ME Noether. And if you read that name, you know, it's basically spells no ether. So, or, yeah. Just another old Tezos Easter egg.
This actually leads us, I think, in a nice way to the governance and how what an amendment actually is in the system, because you've mentioned it twice now. Are amendments like EIPs? Are they like proposals? Are they... I'm trying to picture an equivalent. Are they more like upgrade packages? What are they?
They're upgrades. So formally an amendment is a piece of a comma code for now. So maybe one day we'll change the definition of what's an amendment, but for now it's a piece of a comma code. So it might start as a markdown written somewhere with a few ideas, but you cannot propose that. You need to write it down. You need to test it or run it and do whatever you have to do to make sure there are no mistakes, and then you can propose it to the network. So you inject an operation in the network with your proposal. And then by that, you start an amendment process that is, for now, is a 3-month process where we do a bunch of testing and revision. And then after, if all goes well, people are going to vote several times. And at the end of the 3 months, they will activate your piece of code. That's cool. The idea.
Is there a single client implementation of Tezos, or are there multiple?
So for now, there's one main node that is the one in OCaml.
Okay.
And like I said, there is we split, because of this design, the technically split into parts. You really have what we call the shell that does the storage and the networking. Mm-hmm. And then you have the protocol. So because of this clear separation, actually some people came to the foundation said, we'd like to write a shell in Rust, what do you say? Okay. And as soon as you can take a piece of OCaml protocol, what we call the economic protocol, and run it on your shell, you're good. So
you're good.
That's what they're doing.
And does that almost take the form of a new client then? Like, would that be an option for somebody who wanted to, like, it would be synced together and they could run it OCaml version?
They will speak the same protocol over the network, the same operations, the same everything.
Okay, so the amendments are, like, it sounds like they're not quite the full update or upgrade code finished, but they're like very...
No, they are.
They have to be finished. Okay, it is finished.
Yeah. No, like
it sounds like you, because there's like this 3-month period. You wouldn't change. Yeah, yeah, it but there, that,
it's
or?
Yeah, but it's no. Once you put it in, like you put it into the process, and like basically people propose it, it gets accepted. Hopefully, maybe not. Or, you know, whatever. And then you know, it goes through this. I mean, originally it was like if anyone proposed, that thing would then be put up for a vote, whatever. But basically now it's you know, you put an amendment in. It goes through the amendment cycle for 3 months, and then is automatically activated if it's approved, basically in two different votes. And both of those votes have, you know, thresholds at which they, you know, participation and have a supermajority that need to be met.
How do you in the governance side of things, how do you get engagement? Like, is it a sort of active enough community that you actually have a lot of voting, or do you find the turnout medium?
And again, it's linked to the delegation.
Like, to answer very, very directly, the participation has actually been pretty impressive. And as Marco says, it's because of delegation, basically, like, as a share of the stake. I mean, in the first one we did, you know, in Athens, it was like 88% of the stake, which, you know, and the threshold was at the time 80%. And that's about 200 some odd bakers voting, basically. So, and that's on behalf of tens of, at the time it was like maybe said tens of thousands of people in the community. In the more recent ones, I don't think it was that high. I think it was in the 70s or so. I'd have to actually go back and check, but we've never even come close to missing the quorum and the supermajority. I'm sure at some point we'll have to think about stuff like that and worry about stuff, but we've taken some, as a community, we've taken some preventative measures around, you know, basically trying to make the amendment process more resilient to certain types of attacks and types of flaws in terms of how the quorum adjusted and stuff like that. One thing also is that exists is basically this web application called Tezos Agora, where basically there's like, it's kind of like ETH research meets Decred's Paltea in a way. So it has like a lot of the different folks from, you know, whether it's Nomadic or, you know, Cryptium or Arthur or whomever, the language teams, application developers, et cetera, tooling developers, et cetera, all writing about different stuff that they're working on, different ideas that they have, ways to improve Tezos, stuff like that. And then you have like a sort of a visualization tool that also contains information about the amendments and stuff like that. So people can understand what's going on. And in the future, I think that that'll include a lot more functionality around trying to help with like long-term planning or other kinds of governance tools like signaling voting and stuff like that down the road as well would be really useful. But those are like a couple of, I think that's like a one place where a lot of, you can see a lot of the stuff sort of play out and where a lot of ideas get surfaced or get like revealed first before they make their way into the amendment process.
That actually, that's funny. Somebody went in the preparation for this interview, somebody actually mentioned that your governance dashboard and UI was really nicely built and designed and was curious who did that. And
it's been a group effort and big effort. There's been a big effort to make sure it's a neutral platform as well, by the way. So it's really governed in like a multi-stakeholder that in the long term, it'll be more apparent, I think, but it's very much governed in like a multi-stakeholder way and very neutral, very conservative way.
So like one of the fears of POS systems is this idea of like centralization of power. Do you have mitigations to like avoid some sort of centralization or some sort of inflationary force that like puts more power in the hands of few?
I think like a lot of that probably has to just be community efforts to move delegators off of exchanges and things like that and into self-custody and stuff like that. And even small transitions of people off of exchanges and things, I feel like is probably a good thing, right? So
there's a lot of people, I mean, most of the stake, most of the tokens are staked, either delegated or owned. And and the fees that the delegation service take are pretty
very high. I guess I guess in my mind, I had the idea that people were not all delegating, but if you have a high sort of delegation rate, then I guess everybody is benefiting somewhat equally.
I think the right way to look at this is that if you do not take a part in that, you are punished more than you are rewarded if you do take part in that. That's the idea.
So I kind of want to move on to like how Tezos is thinking about privacy and zero-knowledge proof stuff. Mark, you're a cryptographer at Nomadic, so maybe you can actually speak a little bit about like where does privacy or ZKPs exist in the Tezos system?
So as of now, it's fairly simple because they don't.
Okay.
So that's a short answer. I hope they will be, and it will be part of the next amendment. And so the first thing we're going to introduce is a sampling protocol, which we get from Zcash, and it allows to exchange token privately. So basically, it allows to exchange any kind of token privately. So it's a first step that will allow to, the most simple example, if you do an STO, maybe the people that participate in this STO don't want everybody to know what happens. So you can do an STO in a private fashion with the next subtrain. So that's the first step.
Maybe it's worth pointing out that so the way we are integrating sapling is inside the smart contract language. So basically every smart contract will be able to have its own shielded pool with shielded tokens.
I did read about this. So this implementation of sapling, I'm glad we covered like what amendments are, because this would be, I guess is it finished or is it a work in progress? Where, at what stage is it?
So it's been finished for 6 months.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it's already been like, it would be in the next amendment, I guess, that would then go into review.
Yeah.
What does it mean though to implement sapling? Like I read that it was like implementation of sapling into kind of an upgrade, an amendment for Tezos, but like, it's not going to, it's, you're not sort of saying that you're going to enable Tezzies to move into shielded accounts or something like that, right? This is not like you're all of a sudden Tezos is a privacy coin. And so what does that implementation mean then?
I guess it touches on two parts. It was mainly two parts, and they represent pretty well the two person that works on that, Mark and I. So there was one part was understanding Sapling, understanding the specification that they wrote for the protocol, which was very well written, and it's very, very complex. And I think Mark did an excellent work at that. And then there was a lot of plumbing, like the boring part of making languages work on the Rust and OCaml, oh, yeah. And then making it efficient in the protocol and a bunch of other stuff. And that's where I landed a hand.
But did you rewrite Sapling in OCaml? Is that what you would have had to do?
Part of it.
Okay.
So the people at the Electric Coin Company, they were nice enough not only to design a great protocol, but also to implement it in Rust, in a Rust library, and to make it available open source with a reasonable license. So we just we started from that, we took that, and then we built the pieces that were missing. That's why we call it an integration, because we took a large chunk of their work, but there was another large chunk that we had to do on top of that.
And
Mark was the main drive behind that.
So basically what we started working with was the Zcash library, called Libres Zcash, which basically gives us all the primitive in cryptography, which are signatures, zero knowledge proof, etc. So all of that we had to bind to be able to use it in OCaml. And then what we did, there is a piece of code that you will be able to see in the amendment, which is called Libsapling, which is basically putting all of these primitives together to have like two main operations, one which will go to the client, which is forge the transaction, which allows you to enter an address and amount and you forge the transaction. And one that is going into the protocol, which is called a verify update. And what it does is that it takes what we call a sapling state, which is basically a blockchain. You take a snapshot of Zcash blockchain, it's a sapling state. It takes a transaction, it verifies the validity of the transaction, applies the transaction and gives out the updated state. So we did both those parts, put one in the client and one in the protocol. And as Marco said, the one in the protocol is not done as a first-class transaction, but as a Michelson opcode. And so we created new Michelson type for sapling state and sapling transaction. Mm-hmm. And we offer this as a... So now in Michelson, you can basically, the storage of your contract can handle what we call the shielded pool, which could be seen as a snapshot of the Zcash blockchain.
But it's not actually connected to the Zcash blockchain at all, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And every smart contract has its own pool that is not connected with us.
Got it. After you say this, I'm just trying to think of other use cases. Like if somebody, would it be something like an outside developer team wanted to build something that integrated with Tezos and used Sapling? Is this sort of, I'm trying to picture like what that would actually look like.
Well, really you can think of it like that. You can transfer any type of token as long as you are able to write down the rules that govern how you can buy and sell this token.
But you can't make Tezzies private through it.
Because the rule to be more concrete, the rule to buy and sell a Tezzy is basically giving one Tez or giving one Tez back, right?
I see.
So I can make a smart contract that says if you give the smart contract five Tez, and you want to create five shielded Tez, I will say okay.
So you're creating, you basically allow for anonymity pools to be built on top of Tezos in a way. And you could send your Tezzies into it. And if there were enough people inside, it would potentially like obfuscate the fact that your Tezzies are in there.
Yes.
Okay.
I can see two main use cases. One, which with Marco, we talked quite a lot with the small adoption team that we have here in Nomadic. Mm-hmm. And it's STOs, because it's really the big thing as of now, and there are actually pretty big legal constraints that privacy can Lyft. Another use case would be to actually exchange DZ in a shielded way. And I don't know if someone will do that.
I
guess someone. There are several ways to do that. So maybe we'll see several directions taken. But we really insist on giving out Michelson instruction and people do what they want with that.
All right. So what was the challenge of doing this? You sort of said, you know, it's a different language. So you're kind of like, you know, taking something that was written all in Rust, bringing it into OCaml. But were there any other challenges or what was it like to do this?
So I guess there were a few challenges. The first challenge was that it's a pretty big protocol and mistakes are quite fatal. So I had to go through the spec for a long time and make sure I did not miss any points. And then there was one big challenge, which was the storage part. Basically, as I said, we have to handle a blockchain, which is a UTXO blockchain, which is then different than ours. And all of this in a storage that was made for smart contracts, which are supposed to handle a few values, basically. So we had to quite heavily optimize the storage. Luckily, this problematic had already came up with the big map in Tezos, which is a big data structure that we handle for smart contracts. But basically, usually a smart contract storage is not handled lazily in the sense that you take the storage, you deserialize everything, you work on that, and then you serialize everything and put back in place because it's meant to hold a few integers or maybe a little array, but not much more. So we had to change all of that to make it handle in a lazy way, meaning that we just pick out the part that we need to apply the transaction. So I guess this was a pretty big challenge and handle some data structure that are a bit more complicated than usual, like Merkle trees, and et cetera.
Yeah. I'm wondering, did the size of, like, because you're, if you're integrating Sapling, I guess the idea here is you'd actually be running, like generating ZK SNARK, proving keys and this whole thing, the SNARK would actually have to be generated. Like, you know, we've heard about the challenges of doing that on other smart contract platforms just because of the sheer size of it. Does that matter in this context? Is this also something that you had to take into account?
So the size of the storage definitely matters because then the user pay for it.
Yeah.
But we couldn't do anything about that. So we didn't do anything in the sense that the storage will grow linearly with the number of transactions that is applied. And it has to be that way. And it's quite fundamental because otherwise you don't have privacy.
Yeah.
So any optimization to the storage in that sense is not possible because it breaks privacy, right? Because if you don't keep all the noise, basically you don't have noise and you don't have privacy. So the storage will grow. What we could optimize is the way we handle it so that we don't deserialize everything and just pick out the parts we need to apply our transaction.
Got it. Do you keep up to date on all of the more recent zero knowledge proof like papers and like ideas coming out? You know, you decided to implement Sapling, which is a finished proven thing, but are you also considering like implementing some of the newer stuff, even coming out of ECC?
Yes, we definitely are. So not for this upgrade. The thing with zero knowledge is that when you need to implement a system and you need to write everything in a circuit form to be able to prove the statement. So all of this is quite a big work. So if we just wanted to do transaction with shielded tokens, we didn't need any of these. Sapling uses a very efficient proving system, which is called Sistine. Which major drawback being that you need a trusted setup, but the trusted setup has already been done. So basically it removes, because we are actually using the trusted setup of Zcash.
Got it.
So it removes the big drawback. So there is no reason to use anything else. But for future projects, we are looking into other things. And one we starting looking at, and we actually have a new hire at the privacy team that is working on that for 2 weeks. So it's very recent. It's called Virgo. So it's a trustless system, which is obviously really practical for us and has a okay performance compared to Rust 16.
So you just mentioned Virgo. Where is that from? Like, do you have, maybe we can share a link or something in the show notes.
Yeah, sure. So it's from people from Berkeley and Texas and IM University. Cool. It's going to appear at this year SNP, Security and Privacy Conference 2020.
Nice. What are you doing with Virgo exactly?
So I would come back to the what we are able to do with Sapling is basically handling one shielded pool and making transfer in that one. But really the next step would be, imagine that you have, let's say, a stable coin, which would be represented as a token on the Tezos blockchain. And with this stable coin, you want to add privacy, so you can use Sapling for that. And let's say that someone else is doing an STO and creates a shielded pool with the token representing some part of a company, for example. So if you want to use your shielded stable coin to buy this shielded token, actually you can't with Sapling because we're only able to do transfer inside one pool. Mm. And there is a pretty big technical reason behind that. Is that to be able to do that, we need to be able to handle an arbitrary computation in a zero knowledge proof. Why is that? Is because you basically, you need to be able to decapsulate inside the zero knowledge circuit all the value that you have on the one side and all the value on the other side. So to be able to know that the guy is paying, let's say, 10 euros to get one share. Mm-hmm. And then check the condition that it's okay or not. And so to do this, it's it's technically a bit more complicated because you have to be able to handle arbitrary computation and you need to be much more flexible than what we are with trusted setup systems. So for this, we need either a trustless system or a universal system. And the reason why we're looking into Virgo, well, first, it has very nice assumptions. So it has the same security assumption as the Phi-based system like they use in Starkware. It doesn't have to use all those pairings, etc., which are really good for efficiency, but are a bit more complicated to handle. Basically, the only cryptographic primitives are hashes, which is really simple in that regard. Let's say the advantage it has over the Phi-based system is that it computes directly on a big finite field of big characteristics. So meaning that the computation that you do in the circuits can be done in a finite field that looks like a lot, those you can use in Gross 16, which means that you can do very efficiently in zero knowledge elliptic curve operations. But basically, it means technically that we could reuse all of the work that we have in Sapling, all of the complicated circuit that we have in Sapling, and handle in zero knowledge all the cryptographic primitive that we're using in Sapling, which then we can basically glue another zero knowledge proof from a very different system to our Sapling system to enable to do a Sapling transaction in between pools and compute in zero knowledge and the balance to enforce some price.
Hmm.
So that is the long-term plan, but it's just a plan for now. There is nothing. We just started to look into that. But basically, cool. It would allow to extend with a minimal technical burden what we have in Sapling to make it used in between pools.
Nice. What kind of timeline do you even imagine this having, though? Like you say it's not in this amendment. So like, are you thinking like 2 years out, 1 year out? Like how often are your amendments actually?
The minimal timeline is 3 months for an amendment.
Okay.
But obviously this will not be even in the next amendment. I would say it's 2 years from now.
Okay.
And in the meantime, we have something else that we would like to release regarding privacy, which is the zero knowledge set membership that Marco was talking about. And it comes from our discussion with our adoption team. It's basically so now we are able to let some people create that shielded token. But most of the time for STOs, etc., you do need to have some access control for that for legal reason. And so zero knowledge set membership is simply that you can commit to a set on chain that is not public, but you can prove with zero knowledge that you are in this set without telling who you are.
Oh, nice.
So it would be able to do access control on the shielded pool.
Yeah.
Which, if done not privately, obviously would be make the shielded pool useless.
In general, access control is a very, it's a basic building block for smart contracts. So it's a very requested feature.
Is this sort of a mitigation of some potential privacy leak if people were to use Sapling? Is that what you just explained. It was like, if they were to use this integration of Sapling, there could be some ways of it, of like the users being discovered, and this is a way to control for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's absolutely that.
Cool. Is there any other privacy tech that might be interesting for us to chat about that's actually being built on Tezos? And it doesn't necessarily have to have zero knowledge proofs at its heart, but is there anything else privacy focused?
So for now, we have an on-chain voting amendment. We are looking at that with Marco and other developers, Vincent, and some people from INRIA to basically do private voting. But cool. It's quite, so we are still at the very design phase because it could be quite controversial because it's not obvious since we have a delegation system, it's not obvious that we want to hide the vote, right? It's like if you're your representative for the state, you don't know what these votes are. It doesn't make sense.
That's interesting. That's such an interesting point that's come up a few times. Like this idea of validation and privacy, there's these use cases where you're like, yeah, it would be really great if, you know, people could privately delegate to a validator or if they could privately vote on something, which we do sort of see in the real world. But when it comes to the validation world, as far as I've understood, a lot of the crypto economics are based around transparency in a way, like reputation matters. And so people need to be able to see who votes for what. And so when you add privacy, you actually, in certain cases, like potentially undermine like other levers to keeping some sort of control in the system. And I guess you're facing a similar kind of question.
Yeah, it is quite similar indeed. It's a bit different because for the consensus part, you can actually do private staking. It's quite complicated because if you do it badly, well, first, obviously, you need to be able to produce zero knowledge proof that you behave correctly. That's one thing. Another thing is that you have a huge side channel in the sense that if I own 20% of the stake, yeah, I will produce 20% of the block. Even if everything is in zero knowledge, it doesn't make sense to hide that if I can see the stake that everybody has. But there is actually a paper that handles that, but it's quite complicated and we do not plan to implement it because it's not our priority.
Yeah, but you do get this kind of interesting questions. So it's funny when usually you have a problem and you try really hard to find a solution. And so we've been talking with these researchers and they were like, yeah, so we have 10 solutions, but do you really have a problem? Like, it's been 2 hours of this the first time we met.
It's funny.
For example, they were asking...
The expression there is something like, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail, or something like that. Is that it?
Yeah. So, for example, you were saying, are you afraid that you will not see what your validators are doing, and maybe the concentration of power, etc. So this is one concern. The other concern, maybe, is for which privacy would be actually very good, is are you afraid of bribing, like people buying votes or selling votes? So it really depends on the network and on the. The community, kind of community that you have. So maybe right now, privacy is not, especially at the beginning, I think, remember where Jacob was saying, we spent a good amount of time understanding and explaining to others how the voting works. So I think at that point, not having any privacy was actually very good because everybody could just see the votes, so who's doing what and how. So it was very educational, let's say. Maybe in 1 year, it will be very important to have some form of privacy in votes because there will be more controversial, there will be more. So I don't know. So that's why we're studying solutions, but we don't have any concrete plan.
Got it. Are any of the other teams also working on privacy related projects that you know of?
So we work pretty closely with the people at Cryptium, and we know that they've been working at extending what we have now, that is one contract with one asset that is shielded, to have a smart contract with a multi-asset shielded pool. So basically you will have, you can imagine it as having like Zcash today with the tokens of different colors, and you can exchange only the tokens of the right colors.
Interesting. So this is extending on your implementation of Sapling then?
Yeah, so they will need to change they will need to modify Sapling, so they will need to change the circuit and they will need to redo the trusted setup if they decide to go with the growth 16 again.
Okay.
this has the advantage that you will have potentially larger shielded pools because you can sort of merge several functionally equivalent contracts that they do more or less the same thing, but for different assets. You can just put them all together and you will enjoy better privacy because you have a larger anonymity set.
Yeah, it sounds like cool. And this is Cryptium who's doing this. Chris Goes and friends. All right. Well, thank you all for coming on the show and explaining to all of us a little bit more about Tezos and where it's at today. Also, its relationship to privacy and how, you know, you're also looking to integrate zero knowledge proofs into the system.
Yeah. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Cool. And to our listeners, thanks for listening.